This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. Today's show will focus on population. Craig Lubow will interview Alan Wiseman, who can be described as an historian on population. He's written two books on the subject. But first, I'm Natural Lee, and I have your environmental news. Ranchers set thousands of acres of Flint Hills native prairie aflame each spring to repel undesirable shrubs and trees while promoting growth of nutritious grass for grazing cattle. Massive prairie burns are concentrated in April because landowners have relied upon scientific information crafted decades ago that linked impressive livestock weight gain to consumption of sweetgrass emerging from charred ground. However, new research at Kansas State University, based on a 20-year study of seasonal burning, revealed no measurable negative influence on grass composition or production from shifting burning to fall or winter. In addition to flexibility in managing grassland, the researchers said, adjusting the timing would minimize air quality issues and promote biodiversity. Joseph Crane, a Kansas State Research Assistant Professor, said, quote, burning the prairie is ecologically important to Kansas grasslands and to ranchers in the region. When everybody burns at the same time, it becomes a source of contention for cities downwind of the smoke and creates legal issues when clean air standards are exceeded, end quote. A more diverse burning schedule would alleviate smoke management issues for residents of Manhattan and Wichita, Kansas City, Missouri, Lincoln, Nebraska, and other cities that have experienced problems with plumes contributing to high ground-level ozone concentrations. In addition, fall and winter burns would be less disturbing to wildlife because prairie animals would be hibernating underground or would not have yet built nests when the fields were cleared. Quote, it looks like one of those rare situations where everyone wins, says Crane. Our ranchers win, our prairies win, and our neighbors downwind of the Flint Hills also win, end quote. Movement to end mountaintop removal wins huge victory and huge court victory. Great news, and a huge victory for our water and our future. A federal appeals court stated that U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Army of Corps of Engineers are authorized to enforce laws on water pollution from mountaintop removal mines. After years of effective organizing, the movement, supported by ILoveMountains.org, pressured the EPA to issue a water quality guidance in 2011 that used peer-reviewed science to show the devastating impacts that mountaintop removal coal mining has on Appalachia's water. Unfortunately, a coalition including the National Mining Association and the state governments of Kentucky and West Virginia sued to prevent the EPA from protecting our water from dangerous coal pollution. This important ruling says that the EPA was correct to enforce the law and follow the science to protect Appalachian waters and community health. State politicians will continue to tie the hands of regulatory officials that would conduct meaningful water quality oversight. We need a federal rule that supersedes the corruption of state politicians and makes a real difference for Appalachian water and the future of communities. Last week's important court ruling echoes what residents have said for years. We need strong standards from the EPA to protect the waters of Appalachia from the dangers of mountaintop removal and coal industry run amok. Go to ILoveMountains.org to find out more. California's drought has reached levels so high and widespread that it's now the most severe drought ever recorded by the federal government in the state, according to new data released last Thursday. The U.S. Drought Monitor, which began issuing drought reports in 1999, showed that the majority of the state is now in the worst category of drought conditions. Specifically, roughly 58% of California is considered to be in exceptional drought, which is the most severe of the five drought categories. California's drought has been serious for some time. In May, the U.S. Drought Monitor showed that severe drought, the level just below exceptional, officially covered every inch of the state, setting up unprecedented fire conditions in several areas. The extreme drought and heat have depleted reservoirs and even aquifers, increasing the state's chance of earthquakes, as a recent nature study found. The severity of the drought now is also increasingly threatening the state's $44.7 billion agricultural industry, the Drought Monitor noted, saying California's top soil moisture reserves are, quote, nearly depleted, end quote. Earlier this month, California agreed to impose fines of up to $500 on residents who were caught doing things like washing cars with running hoses, watering lawns during the hottest parts of the day, and letting water from outdoor sprinklers run down the sidewalks. Some Californians are even taking to social media to call out and shame neighbors and businesses that are wasting water. The latest report of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a conservative panel which draws from the expertise of more than 800 scientists around the world, said it is, quote, more likely than not, end quote, that man-made global warming is causing longer and more intense droughts in many regions, including the American Midwest and California. Climate change has also been shown to worsen Western droughts, even if it doesn't reduce precipitation. I'd like to now turn the show over to Craig Lubow.
Okay, thank you, Naturally. And my guest today is Alan Weissman. Our topic is population. Alan has written two books. One is called Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. And his previous book was called The World Without Us. Alan is a journalist and historian, and he's been, I guess, specializing, you would say, in population issues. Welcome, Alan.
Oh, thanks for having me. I need to correct a couple of things. I've written many more books than two, but you just mentioned my last two, and no one would accuse me of being a historian. I am a journalist, but what I have learned as a journalist is that it's not just reporting what's happening, but how did it get to be this way? And that requires us to really delve into history. So I am in the gratitude of, you know, many, many historians who have informed me.
Okay. Let me start out in your book, in Countdown book, that is. You talk about back in the 60s and early 70s when Limits to Growth and the Population Bomb, which was written by Dr. Paul Ehrlichman, and you indicate at the time
that's
that he...
Paul Ehrlich, not Ehrlichman.
Ehrlich. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And you quote, you indicated that there were 3.5 billion people at the time of his book, approximately.
Yeah, that's fewer than half the number we have today.
Okay.
And at that point, a book, The Population Bomb, had gotten the world's attention because population was exploding already.
And now we have about 7 billion.
We're at close to 7.3 billion now and counting.
Okay. And I think the estimates I've seen is that we'll have 9 billion. Is that correct, by 2050?
The United Nations Population Division, which accumulates the findings of the best demographers in the world, has revised that estimate a couple of times, and they're now saying about 9.6 billion, over 9.5 billion people by the middle of this century, and just about 11 billion by the end of it, if we keep growing at the pace that we're growing right now.
Okay. And in your book, you get into tracking some things that started happening approximately 200 years ago when population really started growing at astronomical rates. And you go through several things that you attribute to why the population has started to grow like that, including antibiotics and a lot of other health issues. Can you discuss that some more?
Sure. You know, it's the perfect place to start here because up until about 200 years ago, the human race was, in, for all practical purposes, pretty much another species on the planet. Like every other species, we would make not just copies of ourselves, but extra copies of ourselves because infant mortality, tragically, was very high. And most babies didn't make it till their fifth birthday. But just before the turn of the 19th century, a vaccine for smallpox was discovered, which used to knock our numbers back by the millions every year. And then that was followed by all kinds of tremendous medical advances, pasteurization of milk, more vaccines, extermination of insects that carried epidemics, the discovery that you needed to have proper hygiene in hospitals. And suddenly, far fewer babies were dying, and people were living a lot longer. Before that, the life expectancy for the human averaged 40 years. And now we're, you know, approaching double that. So that was, you know, a really nice thing. And none of us, myself included, are against medical advances. But what it caused to happen for the population started growing. We passed a billion in the 19th century, and by the end of the 19th century, we were a little over 1.5 billion. But then in the 20th century, two things, both of them having to do with food, completely changed everything. It just before World War I, two German scientists created what, frankly, is the most influential invention in all of human history. And that was a way to pull nitrogen out of the atmosphere and apply it chemically to the soil. Before that happened, the amount of plant life on the planet literally was limited to the contribution of that nutrient, nitrogen, from a relatively few plants like legumes and acacias, you know, that could host nitrogen-fixing bacteria in their roots. Artificial nitrogen fertilizer just blew the lid off of what nature could do. And our population, following World War I, started to really climb. And that's when it passed 2 billion in the 1930s. And then by the 1960s, as you started this out, saying we were over 3.5 billion. And when the Ehrlichs wrote their book, they predicted that what was going to happen now, as Thomas Malthus, you know, the infamous economist back in 1798, you know, had said that population growth was always going to exceed food production because population growth is exponential. They said that the teeming masses of South Asia, particularly, were going to collapse in terrible famine. Unless, they wrote, a miracle took place. And lo and behold, it did. We call it today the Green Revolution. And it devised some very clever crossbreeds of plants that would put less energy into the stem, so the plant was a lot shorter, and much more energy into producing extra grain. So suddenly, our rice and wheat and our corn harvests were greatly increased. Those plants were sent off to India and Pakistan, and that saved the day from famine. And everybody said, well, you know, the problem is solved. The human technology is going to always come to our rescue in the last moment and save everything. But actually, that isn't the case. Would you like me to tell you what's happening in India and Pakistan today, the two countries where the Green Revolution was first tried?
Yes, please do.
Well, for a countdown to research it, I went to 21 different countries because, the question boiled down to, you know, do we have too many people on the planet already? What is the safe number of people that this planet can hold? And if it's fewer than what it is today, is there anything acceptable to the great variety of the world's cultures and religions and economic systems, etc., that would allow us to, so to speak, refrain from embracing so much in a time of need? Well, India, what happened with the Green Revolution, it was already so overpopulated, but they dug all these wells, and all these people who would have died of famine didn't, and they lived to beget more people. And today, India is on the brink of passing China as the most populous country in the world. In the meantime, all the wells that they dug for the Green Revolution that were first 50 feet deep, and then they had to go deeper because the water table was dropping, and today they're below 500 and in many cases below 1,000 feet deep. And farmers just can't afford to keep pumping, you know, keep digging deeper. And there's an astronomical figure in my book, Countdown, that I had to verify with the Indian government because I heard it from the farm union in the Punjab, which is the breadbasket. And that figure is that since 1995, 265,000 Indian Green Revolution farmers have committed suicide because they just can't do it anymore, and they do it by drinking pesticide. Pakistan, well, let me preface this by saying that in 1958, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was then President Dwight D. Eisenhower, appointed one of his World War II generals, William Draper, to a commission to study what were going to be the biggest security issues in the post-war era. 2 years later, Draper reported that by far the biggest security issue was going to be overpopulation. And Pakistan, frankly, is what he was talking about. Pakistan today has 190, almost 200 million people, and it's a country the size of Texas, which has 26 million. And if it keeps growing at the same rate by the middle of this century, it is going to have nearly 400 million people. That's many more than the entire United States has today, and it'll still be the size of Texas. And Pakistan can't possibly afford to employ all of these kids who are growing up there. And so you've got a nation filled with under or unemployed, frustrated, angry young men. And we know what happens to those young men when they have nothing else to do. They become basically a breeding ground and a proving ground for what we unfortunately suffer as terrorism now in the world. So this is exactly what Ike was talking about. The founder of the Green Revolution, Norman Borlaug, won the Nobel Peace Prize because he's credited with saving more lives than anybody in human history. But when he accepted that prize, he did not brag about solving hunger. What he said was that he bought a generation of time. This was back in 1970. He said this. He said, and he ended his speech by saying that unless food enhancement technology and population control work hand in hand, we're going to have a terrible, terrible problem. And he spent the rest of his life on the board of population groups as a result.
Now, a few of the other things that you mentioned in the book, besides the vaccines and surgical and fertilizer, you mentioned pasteurization and advances in food. And part of that, I guess, goes with that Green Revolution you're talking about.
Absolutely. The Green Revolution and the invention of nitrogen fertilizer, that was basically it.
And so what I want to ask is, it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you would see the advances in health and food and agriculture as being a much bigger influence on population growth than the Industrial Revolution.
Well, the Industrial Revolution was really one of the drivers that pushed us to come up with these technological improvements. Here's what happened. As Europe industrialized, they had all these factories, and they needed more factory workers. So they started trying to find a way to grow more food. Now, there's a limited number of nitrogen available to push the food supply in Europe. So they realized that guano, which is the excrement of seabirds and bats, is a terrifically rich source of it. So they were sending boats halfway around the world to islands off of Peru, where you had bat dung that was about 150 feet deep. And you know, something like 60 million tons of this was harvested and brought around Cape Horn to Europe to fire the Industrial Revolution. At the same time, the very chemist who discovered the importance of nitrogen invented formula for feeding babies. Now, formula, of course, is very controversial. It's healthier, we all know, to use mother's milk. But the advantage of formula was that women could stop weaning their babies naturally earlier and get pregnant faster to produce more workers for the factories of Europe. But then what happened is that the supplies of guano started to become, you know, they were not renewable resources, or not very as quickly as we were using them, and something had to happen very fast. And it happened in Germany also, because Germany had begun World War One, and the British Army and Navy was blockading it. They couldn't get their boats over to Peru to get all that guano, so their it was like a power project to come up with artificial nitrogen, and that's how it happened. So that you can't really separate out the Industrial Revolution from the incredible advances in the food supply. You also have to realize that as we had more and more people packed into cities, packed into factories, disease could spread a lot faster. So there was much more incentive to come up with ways of, you know, of being healthier, and that helped bring funding to, you know, to people like Louis Pasteur to help develop medicine. You know, necessity is the mother of invention, and that's a wonderful thing. But there are limits to how much we can keep growing, and we can keep finding new solutions on a planet that does not grow. We all know today that the Green Revolution crops, yeah, depend on this nitrogen, which unfortunately has some real downsides. It goes into our rivers, and you can ask any river ecologist about the condition of the Missouri and the Mississippi with all the nitrogen that it's bearing and what it does to the soils that have been overly fertilized with that stuff. It goes down the Missouri-Mississippi system, and it ends up in the Gulf of Mexico, where it creates these enormous algae blooms that then die off, and we have a dead zone the size of New Jersey. And that's not an exaggeration, because I've researched this. All the world's major rivers that pass through agricultural zones have destroyed an awful lot of marine life. Plus, these plants that give us so much more grain per stalk, they were not developed in nature. They did not have, you know, thousands or even millions of years to develop natural defenses against plant diseases and against insects or, you know, anything that was going to attack them in nature. So we have to come up with chemical artificial protection to protect them, and that's what we call herbicides and pesticides. And I'm sad to say that it's the greatest case of mass denial that I know of for us to pretend that poisons that we create to protect plants against pests only select out pests that, you know, organisms that we don't like, and leave alone organisms that we do like, such as ourselves. So you can look, you know, you were just having a report about California and the terrible drought there, you know, before I came on. You know, you can look at all the cancer clusters and the autism spikes and the cognitive disorders in all these agricultural areas where heavy use of pesticides is the norm. And you can, you know, there are a lot of doctors and scientists now connecting the dots between these problems that are becoming epidemic in our society. We pay a price for this stuff, and I don't think that we can keep doing it forever. Plus, there's no place to put all the people. That global warming you were talking about in that report, if you look at the graph of carbon dioxide increases in the planet, and you look at the graph of the incredible increase in human population in the 20th century, we quadrupled. The line goes straight up. It's the identical graph. Yes. The only way we're going to start bringing carbon dioxide down to safe levels is over the next few generations, bringing our population down to safe levels. Fortunately, this is something that we can do. This does not require magic technology. We got the technology to do it, and it's extremely cheap.
Right now, I want to read a quote that you have in your book and ask you a question about that. On page 84, it says, compulsory control of family size, anticipating the outcry, is an unpalatable idea, but the alternatives may be much more horrifying. Now, exactly. I know a lot of people fear the term, they don't like the term population control, because they think of the compulsory things and things, whether it's myth or whatever, that allegedly China is doing, et cetera. So what are some of the ways we can control population, achieve replacement rate, which for listeners, replacement rate would be where we essentially hold the line on population growth because the birth and death rates balance out. What can we do to do that without having something that people think is compulsory control. And when you say, when they say that compulsory control would be less horrifying, what are the alternatives that they were thinking of that would be more horrifying than that?
Sure. You know, you are quoting there a book written by Paul Ehrlich, who also wrote The Population Bomb, and John Holdren, who is currently the science advisor to President Obama, one of our most celebrated physicists in the United States. And just so your listeners are clear, what they did in that book was they listed all the bad things that could happen with compulsory population control, and they rejected it. They said, you know, we don't want this to happen. That's why we want people taking charge of this right now. And I, you know, I have spoken to both men. I mean, I interviewed Paul Ehrlich many times and his wife Anne, who's his collaborator, and the reason why I went to 21 countries was to see, are there alternatives to China's notorious one-child policy? Because nobody wants a government coming in and telling us what to do, you know, with in our bedrooms or with our bodies. You know, as I said, it's a natural impulse to make copies of ourselves. So the idea of not doing something that comes naturally is repellent to us. Fortunately, what I found out is that there are many programs all over the world that are completely voluntary, that have not only worked better than the Chinese program because there's no resistance, they've been enthusiastically embraced in the countries, and these countries range from rich to poor, but in one case, a very surprising one that I'll describe right now, it happened actually faster. In my case, it was Iran. Now, you know, Iran is oftentimes thought of as an enemy state here in the United States. And I traveled to Iran for this book, and there's a lot of things about it that I would not want to live, I wouldn't want to deal with in my life. But in 1979, when they had their Islamic Revolution, a few months later, they were immediately attacked by Saddam Hussein. That's a name that's pretty familiar to us. And he attacked for the same reason that he attacked Kuwait 10 years later. There was an oil-rich province on the Iranian-Iraq border, and he wanted to seize it. And at that time, Saddam Hussein was NATO's ally, and he was provided with sophisticated armaments and even, unfortunately, the feedstock for nerve gas. All Iran had was people. So the Ayatollah Khomeini asked every fertile woman in Iran to do a patriotic duty and get pregnant to help build a 20-million-man army to repel the invaders. And Iran managed to hold Iraq to a stalemate for 8 years, and then a truce was brokered. But then the economist who was head of planning and budget for Iran told the Ayatollah, we've got a terrible problem. All these kids who were born during, you know, the population boom are going to grow up, and we're not going to be able to employ them all. And basically he told them, you know, they're going to turn into what Pakistan is today, and it was going to destabilize the country. So the Ayatollah, actually today's Ayatollah, because the old one passed away, issued a fatwa saying there's nothing in the Quran that says if wisdom dictates you've got the number of children you can responsibly care for, that you can't use any kind of birth control, including a vasectomy for a male or tubal ligation for a woman. And Iran made all that stuff available to everybody. I interviewed an OBGYN, a woman, devout Muslim woman, who talked about how they would go on horseback throughout the country, bringing everything from surgical tools to condoms to everybody. Any people were told, you can have as many children as you want. The only thing that was obligatory was attending premarital classes in which they learned how much does it cost to feed, clothe, raise, and educate a child. And, you know, we all know how expensive that is. The last thing they did that was crucial was they encouraged Iranian girls to stay in school. Because everywhere I went in the world, the best contraception turns out to be female education. A girl who's studying postpones her childbirth, her childbearing, until her studies are done, and then once she's out, she's got something interesting and useful to do to help her family, to make a living, but you can't do that with seven kids. So overwhelmingly throughout the world, educated women choose to have, if they've got the means to find contraception, they choose to have two children or fewer. And two children is replacement rate. That's two people have two kids essentially replacing themselves. Iran got down to replacement rate a year faster than China. And I went to several other countries, Buddhist countries like Thailand, Catholic country like Italy, that just simply has a high rate of female education, more females with graduate degrees there than anywhere per capita. And in every one of these countries, it was always, interestingly enough, an economist who realized that people are our strength, our labor force, but too much is too much of a good thing. And we can't overwhelm our economy with too many kids. So you make family planning available. You give people the opportunity to choose for themselves. You know, that is not a political position. Well, actually, the libertarians believe that everybody should choose for themselves, and I'm all in favor of that. And the problem will solve itself. All we have to do is make contraception available to everyone in the world. And we could do that by doubling the amount of money that is spent worldwide. That would be only $8.1 billion a year. That would get contraception to everybody who wanted it. That's less than your country and mine was spending in Iraq and Afghanistan per month for most of the last decade. The United States, I'm proud to say, is the biggest contributor to contraception worldwide. And if there's one thing that I think we could all get behind is telling our Congress people, please keep that funding in place, because we don't want what Republican President Eisenhower warned us, the worst security threat to us, by having too many people in places that can't afford them.
We do need to take a quick station break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation with Alan Weissman on the population issues.
This Tuesday evening, Radioactive Magazine will look into the legislative status of immigration reform, issues relating to the refugee crisis of the children from Honduras, and immigration issues that impact the LGBT community. Join host Craig Lubo and Christine Chow and their guests, Layla Razavi, Angela Ferguson, and Angie Williams. That's this Tuesday, Radioactive Magazine, 6 o'clock on KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio.
Sister Simone Campbell, of the Nuns on the Bus fame, will be speaking at Community Christian Church on Thursday, August 7th at 7 p.m. Sister Campbell will be speaking on the faithful budget, Medicaid expansion, and immigration reform. More information available at 816-753-4424. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Did you know that you can donate that unwanted car, boat, truck, or motorcycle to KKFI Radio and get a tax deduction for your donation? Find out more by calling KKFI at 816-931-3122. This is Joe Martin from Kansas City, a volunteer for 90.1 FM KKFI, my community radio station.
Hello, this is MC Richardson, KKFI 90.1 FM Programmer's Rep. I know you are sick and tired and tired of being sick and tired, and tired of low voter turnout. I'm fed up and fired up. Can't vote sitting at home. On Tuesday, August the 5th, get off your arithmetic, help collectively getting your neighbors, friends, and relatives get out to vote. This has been a public service announcement by KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio.
Okay, thank you. We are back now with Alan Weissman talking about population. Alan, you mentioned that the United States was the largest or one of the largest contributors to helping...
By far the largest.
Okay, to making contraception available. But I know that at least politically, some of the parties have tried to, and I think they have cut back some. What can we do... What are we headed toward there? What's going to happen if we were to end a lot of that international aid? going to contraception?
Well, I talked to a lot of demographers to find out what the calculation of that is. And you're correct. I mean, I want to be clear. As a journalist, I don't belong to anything, so I can write about everything, and that includes political parties. And I'm not part of any of them. But if Obama and Biden's opponents would have won the last election, they openly talked about cutting funding for international family planning. So here's what the demographers say. I mean, right now, we are adding to the planet every year, births minus deaths, we are adding about, well, it's easier to state it this way. Every 4 days, every 4.2 days, we add a million more people to the planet. I mean, this is not a sustainable figure, folks. And if the funding were cut for international family planning programs, right now there's about a quarter of a billion women who don't have access. And if that was cut, you know, so a half a billion didn't, instead of every 4.5 days or 4.2 days, about every 2.5 days, we would be adding a million people to the planet. And instead of hitting just about 11 billion by the end of this century, we would be hitting 16 billion. And frankly, I don't think we're going to make it to 11 billion because every organism in the history of biology that suffers that expands beyond its resource base suffers a population crash, sometimes a fatal one. And we are now in the most, aside from some microbial blooms out there, we are now part of the most abnormal population spurt in the history of biology. And we don't even realize it because we all were born in the middle of it. And so all these crowds and traffic just seems normal to us. This is not normal. On the other hand, if that funding were doubled to a mere $8 billion a year, I mean, that's not very much money in the global scope of things, we would be headed to under $6 billion by the end of the century, and we would be well on our way to reducing our numbers naturally down to a much healthier balance with the rest of nature. I mean, part of Countdown, we don't have time to discuss a lot of it here, is trying to understand how much nature do we have to preserve to ensure our own survival, because at some point we're liable to push something off this planet that we won't realize that we needed until it's too late. Some of our pollinators, some of our pest controllers. So the point that we are at right now is utterly crucial. We are force-feeding our food supply with chemicals to remain this numerous. So if we make family planning available to everybody and give them the choice, and particularly if we give them the education, they're going to choose to do the sensible thing because it's too expensive to raise a whole bunch of kids. And then as our population starts to come down, we'll be able to phase out gradually all the nitrogen and all the pesticides, et cetera, over the next few decades. You know, I'm not suggesting that we cull our herd immediately by letting a third of the people on the planet starve. No, I want everybody who's alive to have a happy, healthy life. But we just have to start bringing in fewer people to take our place over the coming few decades. Otherwise, I mean, look, our world's already bursting at the seams. There's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now than there has been in 3 million years. And back then it was due to volcanic eruptions. 3 million years ago, with all that carbon dioxide, the seas were 80 to 100 feet higher. And this is where we are headed now. We are watching our seas rise. And I should point out two things about our food supply that's keeping us so numerous. All those grains that we depend on are at their threshold of temperature. They're at their temperature threshold, meaning that for every degree centigrade of increase across the board, our grain harvests are expected to drop by 10%. And imagine how much of the world's most important food, rice, meaning it's the staple for most of the people on Earth, imagine how much of it is grown at sea level. I mean, we're not going to be able to feed everybody if we keep doing this. I would like to see us take control of this. We have the technology. We know how to do contraception before nature does it to us.
That's my next question. I want to give out the phone number. We will take some calls if anybody has a question of Alan. And the number to call if you have a question is 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. Okay. Alan, one of the things we talked about Iran, and you indicated Ayatollah what he said, that the Quran allows for family planning. What about some of the religions, and how do we counter it that do not support that view? For instance, the Vatican that is against most forms, if not all forms, of contraception. And, of course, in South America, it's mostly Catholic countries there.
Well, it's a very important question, because this is what comes to mind whenever anybody thinks about population. Oh, what about the Catholic Church? As it happened, the Catholic Church hasn't been alone in this. Every religion has started out with the edict to be fruitful and multiply. And why? You know, it's, well, for example, our Judeo-Christian religion that so many of us in the United States were raised in, our forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were all polygamists for the same reason the Mormons were later on. It's a strategy to have as many kids as you can and become a mighty nation and be able to, you know, be more powerful and bigger than the Canaanites or whoever the competitor is next door. But in the Bible, it's interesting. You get down to the fourth generation, and one of Jacob's 13 children, Joseph, is a very observant guy. And he realizes that the world is entering a cycle of scarcity. And so he has only one wife and just two children, and he counsels the Pharaoh of Egypt and the Israelites that this is not a time for continuous expanding. This is a time for conserving. And Talmudic scholars, who I interviewed in Israel for this, and Quranic scholars, because, you know, Ibrahim is Abraham, you know, he was also their forefathers, point to this story as an indication that there is a time for everything. And in a time of urgency, such as the one that we're in right now, maybe we have to refrain from embracing so much as Ecclesiastes describes it. As I mentioned before, it's, you know, I go to the Vatican in this book, and I talk to them about this. The Vatican is the smallest country on Earth, population 1,000, most of them, frankly, gray-haired men. But it's surrounded by another Catholic country called Italy, which, as I mentioned, has one of the lowest birth rates on the planet because Italian women are so well educated. Latin America, South America, as you brought up, I have some great stories in this book from Mexico and from Costa Rica and also Brazil, the country where this book is coming out. This book is now out in 13 languages. All of those countries are down to or very close to replacement rate. Costa Rica is below. Brazil is now below. Yes, they were traditional Catholic countries. And in the case of Mexico and Brazil, they did it through, again, economists realized they could not employ everybody. They used the national pastimes there, which are watching soap operas. So you had these great programs, which were really well written. And first, you know, it's kind of subtle. They show that small families are getting along much better than this big family with too many kids. And then gradually, you know, some woman in the big family says, oh, I can't have another baby. I'm so exhausted. I'm going to start taking those pills. And the macho husband says, no, never. And they fight for a few episodes. And then he sees the light. In Mexico, in the first 10 years of airing that soap opera, you can watch, as viewership rose, the fertility rate of Mexico dropped by 34%, more than a third. And that was a wonderful way that it happened. Costa Rica is a really fun story because the evangelical Protestants realized the vulnerability of the Catholic Church right when the United States started making birth control pills available. And we were doing all this stuff for Costa Rica to counteract what Russia was doing for Cuba. This is back in the 60s. The birth control pill was new. So the evangelical churches themselves started distributing it, and they would run radio commercials saying, what, your church says that you are a sinner because you want to have just the number of children that you can responsibly care for? Our church loves you for being a responsible parent. And the defection of the Catholic Church into evangelical churches throughout Latin America now, there is some demographers are predicting by the end of the century, Catholicism will be a minority religion. So I think that there are ways to deal with religion. In Thailand, where there was an AIDS epidemic threatening, they got the Buddhist monks to sprinkle holy water on condoms, and they broadcast that picture throughout the country and got everybody using condoms. And Thailand is now below replacement rate, and it's got the best economy in all of South Asia, and it was an economist who started the family planning program. So, once again, this is something that really spans all of our political differences. This is something that is just good for us to be doing. You know, a lot of people are scared about too many immigrants coming to the United States or to Europe. Well, if there are good family planning programs in the sending countries, there's going to be less poverty and there are going to be less people coming. This is a win-win-win all the way around.
Okay. Before we go on to the next question, we do have a caller online. Caller, would you state your first name and where you're calling from?
This is Patty Brown. I'm in Independence.
Hi, Patty. Thank you for calling in. Do you have a question for Alan?
Well, I did want to say a little bit about the committee that I've been chairing with the Sierra Club here, if you have a couple minutes.
Okay, that would be great.
I've been the chair of the Population and Consumption Committee of the Kansas City Sierra Club, and I wanted to make sure that people know that there are volunteers interested in working on this issue. This local committee was active from 2009 to 2012, and we've only had a few individual actions since then, but we could be easily reactivated, I think, with a few more volunteers. Some of the things that we've done over the years have been book club discussions about population and sustainability. We've had a couple of radio appearances on women's reproductive rights. We've worked with Planned Parenthood. We've written several articles for the local Sierra Club newsletter, and we've written letters to the editors that have been in the Kansas City Star and the Examiner. And then over those years, we did kind of an annual activity around World Population Day where we created several interesting posters. One was titled The Top Sexiest Ways to Prevent Pregnancy. And then we had we made a person-sized condom costume that one of us would wear. And we had created some issues handouts about population that we would put in packets along with an endangered species condom. And then we would distribute hundreds of these around town on that July 11th World Population Day, and especially around the year 2011 when we hit 7 billion. And these little boxes with the condoms, they would have a photo of the endangered species and a funny phrase like wrap with care, save the polar bear, or when you're feeling tender, think about the hellbender. And actually, a side note, the Ozark hellbender is North America's largest amphibian, found in our own Ozark National Scenic Riverways, another place that we're trying to protect from all the visitors, all the humans, the 1.1 million that go down there every year. And we have received a few hundred more of these condoms recently, and we're accepting volunteers to help distribute them. If anybody's interested in that or any of these things that we've worked on or have any suggestions, you can reach me at missouri.sierraclub.org/THB, and you click on club leaders, and I'm under education and population and consumption. That's Patty Brown. And then in the last year, we really focused more on consumption. We had my co-chair at that time started a separate committee about electric vehicles, but we also did a couple of programs about consumption, and then we also had some film events. One in particular was a film called Mother, which was a really good presentation of that had important points, and I think it's really worth repeating. I'm hoping the Kansas Sierra Club would consider doing that.
Can I step in here?
Yes, I
just want to thank Patty because, you know, it's really strange that there are only two environmental groups in our country, in fact, just about anywhere, that have the courage to address population. And one of them is the Sierra Club, and the other one is the Center for Biological Diversity, which is the source of those endangered species condoms that are being distributed. And everywhere I go to give a talk these days, there's someone from CBD there handing out those condoms, and everybody, you know, laughs about it, and then they think about it. And that's really such important work that you are doing. And, you know, some of your listeners may have seen me on the Bill Maher show when Bill Maher said, you know, well, isn't it really consumption? Well, you know, and not population. Look, it's both because, you know, it's really our numbers multiplied by the amount that we consume. So in that sense, the United States is really the most populous country on the planet, not China or India. But the fact is, as I responded to him, you know, if I knew what to do about consumption, I would have written a book about that. But as Paul Ehrlich himself points out, there really isn't any condom for consumption. And we should do as best as we can to limit our consumption. But the fact is, we are all addicted to man-made concentrated energy. And most of that comes from fossil fuels or from nuclear. And both of those things are really damaging our future in a big way. The fastest thing I know that we can do to lower our impact on this planet and to mitigate the problems of global warming, or at least so global warming doesn't increase faster, is by limiting ourselves gradually. You know, people can have two children if they want. If the population doesn't grow, or if people choose to have fewer, population will shrink, and some people will choose that. And I would like to add that to people who say to me, big families are so beautiful, and that's so wonderful to grow up in one, fine, you can have a big family. The happiest family that I know of in my little town in Massachusetts has 9 kids, 2 of them biological, 7 of them adopted. One resource that we're not running out of yet on this planet is children who need a home. And it's a lovely way to solve an awful lot of social and environmental problems all at once.
Okay. And do we have another caller in line?
Well, I did have a question. I did want to say I really like the book Countdown. I haven't finished it quite, but and I'm glad that you're doing this population program. And I want to say, you know, it is difficult to talk about the subject. It, you know, it touches on religion and sex and gender roles. But I think it's important to talk about. It's like the mother
we
of
do
all
have
environmental
call.
Problems.
We have another caller online that we need to move to also.
Okay. My question is, about the focus on women empowerment. I think that's so important, but I also want to say that, you know, reproduction takes a man and a woman. So the question is, what power do men have both as sexual partners and fathers to influence our numbers?
Well, a great deal. I mean, if you haven't finished content yet, you haven't gotten to the part where I talk about the new male contraceptives that are coming online. I mean, of course, condom has always been a male contraceptive, but it's not one that either partner loves all that much, and there are some new ones that are much simpler chemistry than our female contraception. Some of them don't even involve chemistry at all. They involve a simple, very reversible injection that is easier than a vasectomy, and then men can be stepping up to the plate much more than they are right now. Obviously, responsibility is the high, you know, is by far the goal. But the fact is, we don't have time right now to raise people's consciousness all over the world to all consume less or to all be more responsible people. We should always be working on that, but ethicists have been working on that for thousands of years, and people still sin regularly. What we need to
our
do
caller,
is
we,
something that, that
we're just about out of time.
Yeah, we tried.
Caller, you're on the air. Can we have your name and where are you calling from?
Oh, good. This is Ed from Lawrence. I just wondered about this, one of these organizations that helps get the word out and get something done. What about the population connection? It used to be called Zero Population Growth. Is it a good outfit for getting something done?
They were called Zero Population Growth. It was founded by Paul Ehrlich, actually. And then in the 70s and 80s, there was a big backlash about population, and some of it came from women's empowerment groups because they were rightly terrified by the mass sterilization programs that happened in India. So they actually sometimes
Alan, we are out of time.
More men got vasectomized in India than women got forcibly vasectomized. So the whole idea of controlling population.
Okay. Alan, we're out of time. I do want to thank you for joining us. We've been interviewing Alan Weissman, and he is the author of his current book. The most recent is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. And, Alan, do you have a website you can give out real quick? Oh, okay. All right. We need to go to the calendar.
Thank you, Alan.
Tomorrow, on the 5th of August, with After the Harvest and Corrine Page, you can help to glean corn and tomatoes in Lone Jack. And on Wednesday, they will be gleaning zucchinis, cucumbers, tomatoes, and eggplants up in North Kansas City. And they'll be needing people to help pick and transport the food, as there will be over 1,000 pounds of produce. So please call Corrine at 816-853-4460 to help. Also on the 5th of August from 6 to 8 p.m., there will be a Seed Savers 101 class to teach beginners how to save seeds from their gardens. The class will cover why seed saving is important, how to save seeds, and will include demonstrations of different seed saving methods. This workshop is hosted by Seed Savers Kansas City and is at the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center at 4750 Troost. For more information on this event, go to greenabilitymagazine.org. Those are the events I have for you this week. And I believe that Mike is going to tell you about the different environmental shows that KKFI will be hosting this week.
Right. Thank you very much, naturally. Also, I just didn't want to mention real quick that Peaceworks is holding a Hiroshima remembrance, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, on Saturday evening at Loose Park at 6:30 p.m. So tomorrow on Counterspin, it's going to be a look on renewable energy, and the UN's panel of climate scientists have issued grave warnings. So the whole show is going to be on the media and renewable energy. And Sandra Steingraber on Contamination Without Consent on Alternative Radio, Wednesday morning at 9. That's right after Democracy Now! And also on Bioneers, on Friday morning at 9:30, flavors of a whole community recipes for food justice. That's and then on Wings, Saturday at 2:30, water, your new human right. We're going to go out with some Isla Earth, and we'll be back with you next week.